Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay. I am really excited about what we're about to do today. It's our first ever listener-chosen, listener-participation segment. And as I said, this is a new thing, and who knows how it's going to go. It could be a wild success or a colossal disaster. Either way, I think it might be interesting. So are you ready to go?
I for one, am brimming with the confidence of a treasury bondholder.
Oh, there you go. Right. All right. So
fire away.
Well, that's good. All right. So as you probably know, or maybe as you don't know, I don't know, but our topic for this first ever listener-chosen, listener participation segment is tipping points into civil conflict. And Jay and I are going to be discussing conditions under which partisan may or may not devolve into active conflict, the sort of things that might be helpful in preventing that, and maybe even if it's something we should want to prevent in all cases in the first place, where we think we're right now on this kind of continuum in the United States, and what we think about how likely it is that things are going to get worse or better in the near-term future. And right now, we have a number of supporters with us in the chat, so that is excellent, and we will be watching comments so we can see what you all are saying and respond to you throughout our discussion. So here we go. Now, I thought we would start in a good social science way by defining some terms. I always like to do that. And so, Jay, if you're okay with a little term definition, we can start there.
Yes, I would insist upon it.
Okay,
yes.
Well, that's even better. So now I won't impose my definitions on anyone, but to me, here's kind of how I see things. Partisanship is just essentially support for a party, support for an ideology, and it can range from fairly weak, like, I don't know, Trey's support for the Republican Party at this point, I would say, to even homicidally strong. And then I take civil conflict to mean something more serious, kind of a deep disagreement between two or more groups in a society. And, you know, it doesn't have to be violent, but it can be. And I think whether or not there's actual violence, there's almost always going to be some sort of widespread threats of violence, at least, and probably some sporadic acts of violence. And then finally, there's civil war, which is, of course, kind of a wide-scale armed conflict. You've got organized oppositional groups, and one of those groups, at least, is ostensibly in the place of the state. Now, other group may not see them as a legitimate state, which is the whole point, I would guess. But so, Jay, those are kind of my starting definitions. I wanted to get your take on that.
I think that makes sense to me as well. Partisanship, I might define a little differently. And I guess this isn't so much a question of defining partisanship, because I think that was correct. But what we see going on right now isn't even necessarily partisanship. There's other things going on, right? For example, there are folks who are members of the Republican Party, but there is also a strong, the Trumpian populist movement that may or may not be Republican. It sort of attaches itself to the Republican Party at this point, simply because that's where Donald Trump has attached himself. But it doesn't necessarily ideologically attach there. And I think if Trump detached himself from the Republican Party, that would follow, right? So what I'm saying is I think partisanship could be more widely described as factionalism,
sure,
or something like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's a great thing we can look at next is let's talk about what we see as the factions. And I think there are a number of dividing lines here. Like, for instance, there's kind of a north-south divide in a way, right? But it's really more of a urban-rural divide, white, non-white in a lot of ways, college-educated, non-college-educated divide. At least that's kind of how, maybe you call it even a Trump non-Trump divide. And, you know, we have a comment, you know, if Trump detached himself from the Republican Party, would it die? There's certainly a strong element, right, of support within the Republican Party for Trump, or Trump is lending his support to the party, but it gets a little bit blurry here, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's right. And again, what we're talking about when I say factionalism, it is sort of, there are these two camps that folks gravitate towards, and all of the distinctions that you mentioned figure into them. And you know, those distinctions may fit into all of, you know, there are certainly some college educated Trumpians. There are some rural progressives. So I think it's not, but it's a good shorthand for what we're talking about.
To me, I guess I see one of the biggest divide as the urban-rural divide. I mean, you take a look at, for instance, in 2016, Donald Trump received somewhere around 6.3 million more votes than Hillary Clinton in rural counties. And then in 2020, he even did better. He received around 7.1 million more votes than Biden in those countries. So to me, that's really a huge part of it, bigger than the white-black thing, bigger than the college degree, non-college degree thing. Those are all parts of it, but essentially it feels like urban America versus rural America in a lot of ways, I guess.
I think that's probably the better way to look at it, and the other pieces that you're talking about just sort of tend to correlate with that division. So yeah, to pick it up by that handle, I think makes sense. I think there are two competing worldviews that the experience of a lot of urban, or let's even say of suburban Americans, is quite different, has been quite different from those in rural areas over the last 20 years. And it's a change that's happened and happened quickly. And it's not just a change in economics, but there is a sense of different values, a sense of a different level of government. And I'll touch on that in a little bit, because I've actually got some funny thoughts on that. But I think that's a correct analysis of at least a big portion of the divide.
And I think this makes it a little more. Well, it makes it very different from what we saw in our last Civil War, hopefully our only Civil War, right? There's
Civil War.
I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, there's a question here from Bijun, right? How would everyone physically divide for a Civil War to happen? Would all liberals move to the cities, all conservatives move to the rural areas? It's like, well, yeah, in 1861, that was less of an issue, right? I mean, there were maybe pockets of, you know, but
it was pretty rural.
Yeah, it was pretty geographic. But here, I mean, that in a way, I think that's actually, on the whole, probably a saving grace, in that I think it's, you have, given that there's kind of pockets here, many, many more pockets, as opposed to that kind of strong geographic concentration, that maybe makes it, I would argue, a little less likely for some kind of widespread, kind of clear split like we saw in 1861, I would think.
Oh, I'd say much, much less likely. And also, if you consider, you know, in 1860, you were talking about, there was a, definitive state ideology. I'm using state to not United States, but I am the United States, but it was not like the folks in Atlanta were somehow voting differently than the rest of Georgia.
Right. Yeah. No.
They were pretty much on the same page.
Exactly. And I think that's pretty important. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, on the same page, not just, you know, ideologically, culturally, but I mean, legislatively, right? This was an idea. And also in terms of a fundamental view of the country and what the Constitution meant. you know, so often in the South, you know, you will to this day still, you know, encounter people who refer to the late War of Northern Aggression as the war between the states, right? And that's distinct from a civil war, in that a civil war presumes a single union to begin with.
Yeah, and I think having one or just a couple of clear dividing issues makes it more likely, more kind of easier to kind of rally behind that banner. And right now, it seems to me we're not at an instance like that. The way I look at it, there are at least four, and if you're listening in, you know, correct me if I'm wrong or add on, but it seems to me the four big areas of disagreement between the factions, you've got cultural issues, right? The kind of wokeism sort of thing. You've got kind of within that, you have individual liberty issues, I'd say reproductive rights, and much less so, I would say economic policies, you know, not that big of a deal, but those are kind of what I see as the divide, the big divisions between these groups. Am I missing anything here?
No, I don't think so. I guess maybe an umbrella that goes through them is sort of this elitism versus non-elites. And I suppose you can kind of, that could be a proxy for the college education piece. Although I think there's something more than that, right? There are certainly a lot of college educated people who are non-elite.
I guess, and I won't say that that's wrong, because I understand that a lot of folks on the right would define it that way. I almost look at it in a way of saying, well, we have this one group of largely white folks who are sort of trying to defend traditional white Judeo-Christian rights and values and prerogatives against folks who are oftentimes...
I'd strike the white from that, but go ahead.
I certainly wouldn't. When I take a look at the modern Republican Party, especially Republicans that are elected to, you know, high office at the federal level, it's mostly white guys, right? I mean, the Republican.
Right, I wouldn't strike it in saying, I wouldn't strike it from that portion of the sentence saying white people, because I think that's probably correct. But white values. I mean, I would argue.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I see.
You know, again, less government, lower taxes. You know, that sort of thing. I don't consider that to be a quote unquote white
no,
value.
No, no.
I would think that most people would bristle at the idea of there are white values and non-white values.
Yeah, although there are some people who clearly would. That's their thing.
Well, no, right. But that's the majority or minority, extremist type folks.
How bad do you think things are currently? Let's say we have a scale here. Zero is like happy, happy, joy, joy, minimal partisanship. I don't know. All out civil war, we'll call that a 10. Where do you put us on this scale right now, Jay?
I'd say six.
Six. Oh, you know, that's actually kind of about
six
where
and
I'm
a half.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. Yeah. I think about between six and seven, somewhere in through there, because things are not great, certainly. But, you know, to me, not even more important, but something that's also important is not just where we're at, but the likelihood of that position changing, whether it's for better or for worse, right? And to me, well, let's pull these things apart. If we take a look at polling data, all kinds of polling data, things look pretty bad. We have majorities or near majorities saying that they're concerned about the possibility of violence. We have, you know, strong majorities. There was this New York Times poll from late last year. 71% of people agreed that democracy is at risk, but only 7% say it's the most important problem facing the country. So it's like, right. Oh, democracy is at risk, but, you know, we've got bigger fish to fry.
Well, no, here. I mean, I think it's one of those, again, that where I often point to weaknesses in polls. It's one of those kind of, it's an easy thing to say, right?
Well, along the same lines, along the same lines.
What exactly do you mean by democracy at risk? I mean, you think you're not going to be able to vote next fall? Well, no, nobody thinks that.
Yeah. And I think also when the pollsters ask folks, well, do you think that violence is ever justified? And you get these non-trivial minorities, anywhere from like around 10% to 40%. You know, there are a lot of people who might say that, but then would you actually do that? Well, maybe I would. But when we actually, but then again, we actually take a look in threats of violence and almost, you can call them acts of violence, right? The guy who was outside of, Justice Kavanaugh's right house, and the threats against the governor of Michigan. I mean, there's an increase in threats, a huge increase in threats against members of Congress. And of course, there's January 6th, which is more than just threats, right? And now some people on the right would say they'd call the BLM protests political violence, right? So you take a look at all that, and it's easy for people to say, well, I don't know, 6 or 7, maybe we're more like 7 to 8 or something like that. Well, what do you think about that?
So again, I take issue that sometimes these polls, I think, are meant to inflame and to generate a clickable headline, as opposed to really delve into what people think. If you ask me, is political violence ever justified? I would answer absolutely, right? And I think people would be like, oh, exactly. The FBI is listening. I mean, they're writing all this down now. But I would say, was it justified in 1775? Well, yeah. Would political violence be justified in, say the Warsaw Ghetto in the 1940s? Absolutely. Was political violence justified during slavery? I think there's a strong argument there, right? I mean, John Brown was a nut, right?
Yeah,
I think you could, you can say, I think there's a non-frivolous case to be made for John Brown or for even, like a Nat Turner. I mean, that sort of thing when people are pushed to a place where, they don't have, any sort of other, Democratic/Republican outlet, to change things, where they don't have any type of protection of fundamental rights. It does devolve to that point. So my long answer is saying, I think there are a lot of people like me who would say, sure, political violence could be justified. Would I justify it over, I didn't get what I wanted in the debt ceiling deal? Well, no. I think that's the question. The second question is, when is it justified that, you start to winnow that stuff out? So,
but I think
what I'm saying is, if things could work, could look worse than they are. And there's always, someone will always be able to point to, if we don't do this, people will die. Right. There's always that thing of somehow then everything's going to be justified. So,
well, and I think Urgicles has a point here. You said some politicians are using this rhetoric and I would say especially Republicans toward Democrats. Right. And I think that's true, because while I agree with you that, yes, there are conditions under which, sometimes you need to refresh the tree of liberty, right, with the blood of patriots and tyrants, that sort of thing. And my God, it quote Jefferson. But I mean, you could find the same sentiments in the Declaration of Independence. And though it seems to me that point is right, that you can. There's a scenario, there's a worldview right now with, I would say, a non-trivial percentage of Americans who are inflamed by the Tucker Carlson's and the far right voices in that, saying that, hey, the election was stolen and the federal government is run by a corrupt deep state. And so therefore, what are you going to do? Well, join the Proud Boys and get involved and storm the Capitol. And there are more than a few people who believe that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you have, like, as Alex points out here, the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Lauren Boberts, and these people are either nuts or, and I think this is far more likely, they know exactly what they're doing, and they know there's a lot of money and power to be gained by encouraging this sort of thing. And to me, those people are, I cannot think of more unpatriotic Americans than those folks who wrap themselves in the mantle of sham patriotism for fundraising purposes. It makes me almost physically ill.
So I would take and again, this isn't anything I have any actual knowledge on, right? But this is just my supposition that a lot of those two aren't mutually exclusive. You can be absolutely nuts, and believe sort of this conspiracy theory and also realize, hey, it's really good for fundraising. There's often a happy coincidence in those sort of things, and it kind of reinforces itself, right? My conspiracy theory must be right. Otherwise, I wouldn't have so much support. I'm paying Marjorie Taylor Greene and some of those others sort of the compliment of saying, I don't think she's, I think she's truly nuts and not just a sham patriot.
Yeah.
So,
you know,
something else I would add though is, and this is, you know, a piece for me, as you know, I'm a big look at the historical perspective piece. And also, so when I come up with my 6.5, you know, or so, I'm thinking compared to what, right?
Yeah. No, yeah.
I think we sort of, you and I and most of our listeners, really grew up in a period of fairly tame politics. You had mentioned a couple weeks ago, the bombings of the 1960s and 70s. You know, when you compare political violence, you know, the storming the Capitol was horrible, but compared to, I don't know how many, you know, mail bombs, right, of the 1970s.
Yeah, to kind of give you
compared to
some
assassination,
context, yeah.
The RFK and Martin Luther King and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, right now, according to FBI stats, we're averaging around for the last decade or so, averaging around 200 or so domestic terrorism incidents. Now that's like way lower than that's less than in the mid 70s to the mid 80s. Actually, it was over double that. Now that's just a rough, you know, what constitutes. But the point being is,
part of it also is the ubiquity of it in terms of you're able to see it all now immediately real time, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Some nut vandalizes a post office. You know, in rural Montana, and everybody sees it all of a sudden, and it's domestic terrorism. Whereas 30 years ago, it would have been, you know, maybe made the local news and that's it. So I think that sometimes the sense of this is different. And also, again, looking back, not just the 1970s, 1960s, but, you know, take a look at the 1920s and 30s.
You
know, the socialist upheavals and labor riots and so forth. You know, you go back further and then you got a real civil war. You've got, you know, lynchings in the South, you know, sort of, I don't want to say standard, but not, certainly not uncommon, you know, going back from keep in mind the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan had a tremendous march on Washington. They're all there in the hoods and the cloaks and the burning crosses. You know, they've got members of Congress and Supreme Court justices looking out the window, giving them the thumbs up. You know, so that's why I'm saying when I say, you know, compared to what?
Yeah, no. And I think we've seen it from both sides right now. I think it's much more, you know, that kind of, take back America, white nationalist sort of thing, as Alex points out. But in the past, we've seen it from the left or on very far right and the KKK and all that. So, but to me, I think that why we're very unlikely to move into some sort of civil war, destruction of democracy thing is, and I thought about this a lot because I've taught a class a number of times on freedom and civil rights. And There's a theory called system justification theory, and basically this is a thing from the far left. Jay, you won't hate it, but it's this idea of why don't people? Because there are a lot of folks on the left forever who said, why is it that we don't break the chains of our oppressors, sort of thing, right? And there are a lot of folks giving that a lot of thought, and they basically come up with kind of five main reasons. Number one, there are some people who just don't see the system as illegitimate, right? And maybe that's because of false consciousness or something else, but they just say,
right. I suppose that's me raising my hand right now.
I would say, absolutely, there's plenty of false consciousness there. But, or you can see the system as illegitimate, but you're like, you know what, it's working for me. So yeah, it's really too bad. Thank God I'm a white male, you know, and I'm not going to rock the boat. Or you can just say, you know, I'm just not angry enough. You don't get worked up enough, or you feel you have too much to lose. Or finally, you think, well, what can I do? How can I make a difference? And you combine all these things together, and it turns out it's really difficult to get a critical mass of people to kind of band together and rise up and really kind of concerted, the kind of concerted action you would need for a civil war. And that's why I think, yeah, we're at 6, 7 or so, but honestly, I don't see us moving into 8 or 9. That's kind of where I'm at.
We hope you enjoyed this preview of our supporters exclusive midweek show. If you'd like to hear the rest of the episode, we hope you'll consider becoming a supporter. Supporters get ad-free access to all of our shows, membership in our Politics Guys Discord group where you can join in on the conversation, and other benefits at different levels of support. To become a supporter, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us through Venmo, we're at Politics Guys, or through PayPal. You'll find all of our support links in the show notes as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get the midweek show, but you're not in a position to become a financial supporter, that's not a problem. Just send me an email at mike@politicsguys.com, and I'll be happy to get that set up for you.